Many reasons have been put forward to account for the late 19th century's upsurge in anti-Dutch feeling in the region and for the parallel upsurge in Islamic zealotry in the East Indies. Poverty, alleged colonial tyranny, corruption, the unbearable heaviness of the imperial yoke, all of these factors here in the Indies, as in a score of other territories similarly burdened by the authority of outsiders, bore down on the local people, and as their education and awareness of the world increased, began to make them restless. Sporadic revolts, irritatingly persistent outbreaks of unrest in other regions of Dutch East India, in Aceh and Makassar and the Moluccas particularly among them, all appear to have been driven by what historians would later accept was a growing mood of restlessness, just as anti-colonial movements were developing at much the same time in India and Malaya and elsewhere. In Java and Sumatra, however, there was one additional factor that seemed to have played a role in fomenting a mood of general popular unease, and that, surprisingly, was the devastating eruption of the huge volcano. The geological processes that destroyed Krakatoa, in other words, appeared to have played no small part in creating the political mood of the moment. That the volcano and the economic and social dislocation it caused had an effect of some sort now seems undeniable, but whether its impact was limited and peripheral, or whether it can be linked to the development of movements that in turn led to the eventual seeing off of the Dutch, is a matter of some debate. The immense geophysical turbulence of the East Indies, with its 21 active volcanoes and 10 active solfataras on the island of Java alone, has long played an important part in mystical belief. Each volcano has a god, Krakatoa's being the widely feared Orang Aliye, and he readily displays his anger with earthly conditions by spewing forth fire and gas and lava. But more, the Javanese in particular take a global view of their volcanicity, believing that their island is where the earth and the heaven have been arranged closest to one another on the planet, and where transmissions between one sphere and the other are more common and more intimate than anywhere else in the world. So on Java, volcanic eruptions are much more than simple expressions of dismay by distempered deities. They are astral messages sent down directly to the earth and of an importance which would be ignored only at mankind's peril. Given such a system of beliefs, it might not perhaps be wholly unreasonable to suppose that Krakatoa's almighty act of self-immolation in August 1883 was seen locally as signifying the most profound of inner meanings. So, did the eruption somehow act as a political catalyst? Did it, for reasons rooted deep in this Javanese mysticism, drive a wedge between the terrified and dispossessed people and the paternalistic Dutch authorities? Did it then nudge them towards the comforting stability of the Islamic Church? And did Islam's subsequent defiant stance against colonialism then offer somehow such succour and comfort to those who were dispossessed and terrified that they wholeheartedly accepted the offer to follow its precepts and its demands, however extreme they might be? And still further, did Islam come to act as a banner under which these people might turn against the Dutchman, whom they could now, all of a sudden, and with the clarity of their new perspective, see not as their benevolent leaders and well-intentioned mentors, but, as so many imperial agents are eventually viewed, as their oppressors? And if Krakatoa somehow played a part in this chain of events, then can the eruption of Krakatoa come to be seen in a sense as an unwitting, readily adopted political event in and of itself, an event the effects of which would resonate in the East Indies for many years to come? At the time of the eruption, the Dutch in the East Indies were showing signs of momentarily losing their grip. The imperial purpose, quite coincidentally, seemed suddenly to be faltering. The old self-confidence of the Hollanders had taken a beating, and a mood of reform and change was in the air. The cause for their discomfiture, though they might be loath to admit it, had been the publication in Amsterdam 20 years earlier of the book that had sent a shudder through the conscience of an entire Dutch people and forced them to wonder just why they were running, and in so questionable a way, a colony so far from home. The short novel that had this extraordinary effect Netherlands-wide was written by a man who hid briefly behind the pseudonym Multatuli, and it was called Max Havelaar. The author was, in fact, a young colonial official named Edward Douws Dekker. Multatuli, a somewhat self-pitying name, is Javanese for I have endured much. In 1855, and as the protégé of the Governor-General of the day, he was appointed assistant resident of a small West Javan regency called Lebak, which is coincidentally not far from the garrison town of Serang. He'd arrived there under the impression that he was on a secret mission to correct a slew of injustices that he knew had been visited on the local people. But over the 3 months that he remained in the post, he managed, by a relentless campaign of whistleblowing, to ruffle the feathers of the entire Dutch administration, and after uncovering tales not just of mismanagement and inadvertent cruelty, but of murder and corruption on a far greater scale than he imagined, he resigned. He returned to Holland and eventually wrote the book that was to become one of the great landmarks of recent Dutch literature. It was published in 1860, to the shock, astonishment and dismay of an entire country, which learned, through Max Havelaar for the first time, the details of the manner in which their officials were running their most distant and wealthiest possession. The book was a savage indictment of the colonial attitudes of the Dutch, and in particular of that astonishingly exploitative Dutch invention known as the cultuurstelsel, the cultivation system, which was introduced in 1830, and which compelled all villages to set aside one-fifth of their crops for the government in order to pay the cripplingly high land taxes. All villagers were held collectively responsible for the tax payment, and to ensure that responsibility was met, none of them could travel beyond his or her village without official permission, and which was seldom given. The system made the Dutch rulers fabulously rich, but upon its exposure in Max Havelaar, one critic wrote that he had now seen demonstrated that almost nothing of the great revenues from the island was devoted to the education or benefit of the natives, that no mission or evangelical work was undertaken or even allowed by this foremost Protestant people of Europe, and that next to nothing in the way of public works or permanent improvements resulted to the advantage of those who toiled for the alien, absentee landlord, the country being drained of its wealth for the benefits of a distant monarch. The Dutch, government and planter alike, for Max Havelaar focused much of its attention on corruption within the coffee plantations, were condemned as synonyms for all kind of rapacity, tyranny, extortion and cruelty. Dekker cheekily dedicated his book to King Willem III, as emperor of the glorious realm, he wrote, that coils yonder round the equator like a girdle of emerald, and where millions of subjects are being maltreated and exploited in your name. For doing so, and for daring to write so intemperate an expose, and to lay it before a smug, insouciant Dutch public, Dekker was vilified, attacked, and forced into the same kind of exile, he died in Germany, that was suffered by the similarly evangelizing Dutchman, Vincent van Gogh. But reform of the kind that Dekker was demanding did eventually come about. Max Havelaar was debated in the Dutch Parliament. The iniquities of the cultuurstelsel, so vividly described in the novel, were slowly recognized, and through the years following the sensation, it was gradually abolished. Pepper was freed from its strictures in 1862, 2 years after the book's publication. Cloves and nutmegs were taken off the list in 1863, tea and cinnamon in 1865, coffee in 1866. And eventually, a wholly new approach to the governance of the colony took root. By the end of the century, the East Indies were ruled under the principles of a brand new and so-called ethical policy. The Dutch now started to take sedulous care of their subject peoples. Under the new scheme, they employed officials not simply to repress and squeeze profits from the territory as in the past, but now to take charge of public health, to improve education and to offer agricultural help, the better to advance the condition of the people rather than merely to exploit them. This reform, too little, too late, and not enough to still the nationalist mood, was perhaps Edouard Dekker's greatest legacy. But it was not to be in place until the beginning of the 20th century, at the time of the Krakatoa eruption, and at the time of the events that led to the Banten Rebellion, much of the old colonial attitudes and most of the old colonial establishment still held sway. Matters were beginning to change and to improve, but they had not yet done so, and the unreformed state of the colony left ample room for those who were determined to agitate against the Dutch and their unrequested mastery to make such mayhem as they could. Among those most eager to lead the agitation and to make the most mayhem, especially in Banten and the ultra-religious west of Java, were the more conservatively minded Muslims. 170 million Indonesians are currently members, notionally or devotedly, of the Islamic faith. It is the most populous Muslim country on earth. And the greatest of all success stories, if numbers are the best indicators of success, in 14 centuries of Mohammedan proselytizing. All of its people are either converts or descendants of converts. It's easy to forget that the world's great Muslim populations in Iran, Malaysia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia all belong to a church that is quintessentially and inescapably Arab. Indonesia was converted by Arabs, and it looks to Arabia and Arabians still for spiritual succour, guidance, and direction. Islam, it should not be forgotten, is at its heart an imperial religion, and Arabism is perhaps the greatest of all contemporary imperial movements, one of the many reasons for its current collision with the West, which of course has its own competing, profit-driven imperial agenda. The collisions between the Arab-inspired Islam and her agents, the money-driven, trade-driven West and hers, have been many and various. Those that occurred in the East Indies in the latter part of the 19th century are now, when seen from today's perspective, classics of the kind. Islam first came to the East Indies in the 13th century, and ironically, considering the present schism between East and West, between spirituality and materialism, between God and Mammon, it came with Arab traders who were in search of business there. There is a grave of a sultan in North Sumatra that dates from 1211. There is another at Gresik in East Java, which sports designs indicating that it had been carved by masons from India and that it was made in 1419. A late 15th century mosque in Demak, on the north coast of Java, about 300 miles east of Batavia, was clearly the result of architectural compromises between Javanese and Arab builders. It had a holiness to it that the local mullahs regarded as both profound and ineffable, and they declared that to visit it seven times, though there is no spiritual explanation for the number, had the spiritual worth of the single Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. In Banten itself, Islam became properly established at the beginning of the 16th century, a little later than much of the rest of Java, and considerably later than in North Sumatra. It caught hold in Banten immediately, spread with extraordinary speed, and before long became a model to which Arabs and Hajis alike could point with pride. Among the Bantanese and their coastal compatriots, the Sundanese, the religion achieved a degree of penetration like in few other places in the entire archipelago. The West Javanese soon had a reputation for being more assiduous, more spiritual, more fundamentalist than almost any others. It was difficult for a traveller to pass between Batavia and the coast without seeing scores of mosques and without hearing the five times daily cry of the muezzin calling the willing faithful here in their millions to prayer. Having said which, it's important to remember that East Indian Islam was always of a much milder stripe than that practiced in the Middle East and in Africa. The lingering influence of Hinduism in particular led to a significant local dilution of Islam's rigours. Regional superstitions, pockets of animist beliefs, and a whole host of religious oddities washed over the mullah's teachings, with the result that the Islam that developed in Java especially turned out to be highly syncretic, a maze of compromises that drew influences not merely from Mecca, but from a patchwork of other beliefs as well. Yet despite this rather off-centre aspect of Javanese Islam, a central feature of life on the island, and in particular of the lives of most Banten Muslims, remained the pilgrimage to Mecca. Although all good Muslims everywhere were required to take part in the Hajj, figures compiled by the Dutch government suggest that as a percentage, more Bantanese and Sundanese went to perform the obligations of orthodoxy than any other group in Java. And the figures were all the while rising steadily. In 1850, just 1,600 undertook the Hajj. By 1870, it was 2,600, and in the 1880s, an average of 4,600 took off on boats to Arabia. The Dutch authorities were understandably wary of the practice, and they could well have used the harsher regulations of the cultivation system to curb the travel of suspect individuals, for instance, to prevent it. But they soon realised that to forbid a custom of pilgrimage that was centuries old would have been fatally imprudent. All they could then do was to try to make sure the pilgrims were persuaded to keep their potentially corrosive sojourn in Arabia as short as possible, and to monitor the behaviour of them all just as soon as they came home. What bothered the Dutch was that the longer the pilgrims stayed away, the more Arabized they were on return. The more they then held the Dutch infidels in contempt, the more they tended to take part in violent acts against the colonial power. Mecca was nothing but a hotbed of religious fanaticism, wrote Snoek Hoogrange, the leading Dutch scholar on Islamic matters of the time, where people were inculcated with hostile feelings against Christian overlords in their homeland. The history of militant Islam, I should say parenthetically, is long and extremely complex, and well beyond the scope of this chapter's account of the political effects of Krakatoa's eruption. Yet it is perhaps worth mentioning that the rise in extreme anti-Western Islamic feeling in some corners of the world, like the Dutch East Indies, came about when it did and as it did, because elsewhere in the Muslim world, the Islamic Church in the late 19th century was coming under an increasing threat from Western imperialism. In North Africa and the Middle East, for example, European powers, the French and the British most notably, were seizing territory or assuming influence on all sides, to the dismay of the mullahs and the mosque. The mullahs in Mecca not unreasonably saw those pilgrims who were coming from the east, from lands that were already under the unwelcome control of Dutch infidels themselves, as having a use. They could perhaps be messengers, men who could return to their homes to spread the word, to try to reassert Islamic purity and authority, and somehow eventually, as their supreme goal, to wrest the archipelago from the menace of the unbelievers' control. The fact that the Krakatoa tragedy took place just when these developments were beginning to unfold is one of those historical coincidences simply too attractive to ignore. It's usually the case with the upsurge of any political or religious movement that one figure, a charismatic leader or a demagogue or both, becomes the identifiable personality of the movement. Such was very much the case in West Java, with the steady rise to prominence of a Java-born mystic named Haji Abdul Karim. Karim, whose teachings played no small role in the Banten Rebellion, was, from the middle of the 1870s, the leader of a powerful local Sufi movement, which he and a corps of acolytes managed from his headquarters in Banten town. Abdul Karim had started his Islamic education early. He'd been to Mecca when he was a mere child. By his teenage years, he spoke and read fluent Arabic. He had a scholarly knowledge of Islamic theology. He returned to his birthplace in his late 20s, and as his mentor back in Mecca suggested, he set himself up as a seer and a messenger of Allah, a role which, since he had been in trouble with the Dutch authorities for violating passport regulations, and so was already regarded as a scourge of the infidels, a thorn in the imperial flanks, endeared him mightily to the Javanese masses. By the late 1870s, his home had become a place of pilgrimage. Tens of thousands of fanatic Bantanese and Sundanese would come each day for a laying on of hands or a few words from this remarkable man. He was showered with arms. The Dutch resident, suspicious no doubt, but well aware of the power of the man, paid an official visit. At first, the message that this Wali Allah offered to his growing army of followers was simply one of the need for piety, orthodoxy, and asceticism. But as the number of his disciples grew, so his message began to change, though whether it did so at the behest of Mecca or in Karim's own initiative isn't clear. His revised version was considerably more alarmist, and for the ruling Dutch it was deeply ominous, for Abdul Karim began to predict what other devout Islamic seers were busily preaching and worryingly to the authorities in other regions of the world, that the Mahdi, the messianic figure who would appear to save the world from godlessness in its later days, was shortly about to appear. And in this pronouncement appears at last the key, the single link of chain that connects the two most apparently unconnectable features of, on the one hand, a volcanic eruption, and on the other, a movement for political change. The prediction, made by this single charismatic Islamic mystic, and ardently accepted by tens of thousands of his followers, that the Mahdi was about to come, turns out to be intimately connected to the eruption of 1883, and it does so because the version of Islamic teaching that deals with the Mahdi and the holy war that the Mahdi will wage against the infidel holds that the arrival of the Mahdi is always accompanied by a series of definite signs, There would be diseases of cattle. There would be floods. There would be blood-coloured rain. And volcanoes would erupt, and people would die. And it so happened that each and every one of these predictions had occurred in Banten in precisely the manner that Haji Abdul Karim had forecast. Cattle were dying on all sides because of an uncontrollable outbreak of murrain, the foulest of all bovine plagues. The West Javan coastal villages from Merak south to Labuan had been devastated by tsunamis. The rain was still tinted brown with the ash that swirled ceaselessly in the skies over Java. The island of Krakatoa had blown herself to pieces, and 36,000 people had died in the tidal waves from the ash flows and the gas flows that had resulted. What clearer signs could any devout believer possibly demand as an indication that the day of judgment was at hand, that the Mahdi was on his way, and that the holy war against the infidel was about to begin? Small wonder, some might say, that two of the foot soldiers in the coming war, dressed in martyr's white, pressed their attack against the unbelievers just weeks after the eruption was done. The fact that Abdul Karim had himself long since returned to Mecca to assume a senior post in the Sufi hierarchy there made no difference. His teachings had been heard, his disciples were in place, and a network of his so-called tariqat, the brotherhood he had established to carry on his work, was functioning like a well-oiled piece of machinery. One of those who would be bold enough to link the two events, to put Krakatoa at the head of a long chain of happenings that culminated in the 1888 rebellion, was by chance one of the eruption's eyewitnesses. He was called R. A. van Sandyk, was a technical school teacher from Deventer in central Holland, and had been hired by the colonial government for his knowledge of hydraulics. He just happened to be aboard the official vessel, the Governor-General Loudon, when Krakatoa exploded. He watched with horror as the events unfolded. He plunged promptly into the relief effort, learning as he did so as much as he could about the social conditions of West Java and how they had been changed by the tragedy. In 1892, he wrote a short, seven-chaptered book, Lead and Leaf in Banten, Sorrow and Love in Banten, which was the first to offer details of Abdul Karim's predictions. The translation here may be a little shaky, but the message in the relevant chapter is abundantly clear. The mullahs and the teachers of religion in the Pezantren, the Islamic schools, who were stirring up the people in Banten, took the opportunity given by the enormous and deep-felt impression left by the Krakatoa eruption to expand their influence. Was it not, they said, the revenge of Allah, not only against the unbelieving dogs, but also against those Bantanese people who were serving these kafirs, these infidels? There was no doubt. The disaster of Krakatoa was a sign of God, the great omen of which the holy Abdul Karim had spoken. Had he not predicted heavy earthquakes and the end of the world? And see, the sun was darkened for hours, and now, after the eruption, the sun shone as a red or sometimes as a grey or blue ball on a grey firmament. Was this not strange, these nameless colours shining these days at twilight? Did not God create the tidal waves that rose 30 metres above normal sea level? And did he not speak in a thunder, as a result of which the whole of Banten shook in deepest darkness? And ask the fishermen of the Sunda Strait, has not the bottom of the sea been raised by a god? Has not three-quarters of the island of Krakatoa disappeared? Are you blind to all these deeds brought about by God? Be humble for the Almighty. Pay for your sins. Can you still doubt, said the mullahs, now that you know that Abdul Karim has predicted all this? A somewhat more sinister related development was the discovery that autumn of a number of documents and letters written in Arabic which were circulating in the towns of Banten. The Dutch colonial police, who managed to intercept specimens, said immediately that they were attempts by foreigners to foment trouble in the wake of the eruption, and though most of the letters in fact seemed to deal with the immense social problems caused not by Krakatoa but by the cattle plague, suggesting that it had been caused by a wrathful Allah to demonstrate his displeasure with the Dutch infidels and their local stooges, the letters' interest today turns more on their origin than their content. Most of the letters appear to have come via messengers from Arabia itself, and though the entire peninsula was then under the rule of the Ottoman Turks, it was still the fountainhead of Islamic orthodoxy. And most especially among all its various kingdoms and fiefdoms, that particularly devout desert southern track of the peninsula known as the Hadramaut, now part of the eastern side of Yemen. The fact that 19th-century Java was being whipped into a fury in part by Yemeni fundamentalists, either acting directly, it is said, though not proven, that Arab mullahs were in Banten soon after the eruption, or indirectly, the letters and distributed propaganda documents, or through their proxies, of whom Abdul Karim was the most prominent of scores of Arab-educated Hajis, is oddly mimicked by similar events that appear to be taking place around the world today. The spiritual vigour behind today's Islamic militancy comes in large measure from the mosques of the Hadramaut, and there are figures abroad today, Saudis and Yemenis both, who are every bit as defiantly anti-Western as was the East Indies Haji Abdul Karim more than a century ago. The historical parallels are intriguing, and with implications that'll keep scholars busy, no doubt, for many years. The first two strikes on the soldiery of the Sarang garrison turned out to be part of what would become a much larger plot. The planning was meticulous, and it took years. The first suggestions of rebellion were made just after the eruption in 1883. The outbreak itself didn't occur until 5 years later, July 1888. In all cases, the leaders and the instigators were Hajis. The rebellion was Islamic-inspired, Islamic-led. Teams of 40 were selected. Oaths were demanded and offered, with all the participants solemnly agreeing, in writing, to perform the killings. Fighters were chosen, were schooled in the techniques of pentjak, an East Indies version of fencing, and were heavily armed with newly made swords and lances and the viciously sharp curved daggers called goloks, all of them made by sympathetic metal workers in Batavia. White robes and white rag turbans were made and collected for the warriors. Lists of targets, all of them Europeans, all of them Kafirs, were selected. Rumours were circulated that a holy war was at hand, creating frightened apprehension among the Europeans, a mood of eager anticipation among the natives in their kampongs. Come the morning of Monday, the 9th of July, 1888, and the stage was properly and fully set. The first attack was made at a village called Saneja, which today is a suburb of the industrial town of Chilegon. Long before dawn, teams of partisans cut the telegraph wires, blocked the escape roads, then at first light swarmed into the compounds of the various Europeans, the assistant resident, the salt sales manager, the collector, the junior controller, and hacked them and their families down wherever they were found. There was nothing pretty about the assault, and little that was noble. The first family to fall victim was that of a clerk named Dumas. While he managed to at first escape through a window, his armour, whom the assailants mistook for his wife, was attacked with lances. The Dumas baby was sliced to pieces in her arms, and when the servant was later found, she was alive but terribly lacerated, still cradling the dead infant. Dumas himself was later found sheltering with a Chinese. He was dragged outside and shot. The prison was attacked and broken open, the inmates freed. The assistant resident, a man named Johann Hendrik Goebbels, was chased from one end of town to the other. His young daughter Ellie was stoned to death, her head crushed with a boulder. Her sister Dora was hacked down and killed by men who, as the morning wore on, were increasingly frenzied, seemingly enjoying what was fast becoming an orgy of bloodletting. Goebbels himself was eventually found and stabbed to death, and his body was dragged out into the open for the rebels to see, and at which they howled their approval. There were occasional acts of unexpected mercy. Mrs. Dumas was found, for example, and, somewhat improbably, was released after she had signed a paper agreeing to be converted to Islam. But otherwise the killing and sacking went on and on for hour after hour, until late in the day there arrived a full battalion of Dutch infantry and a squadron of cavalrymen. The infantrymen were armed with a new and quite terrifying weapon just arrived from Holland, the repeating rifle. It was this weapon, above all else, that finished this fierce but in the end very brief rebellion. The white-robed rebels believed, as holy warriors in any conflict are wont to do, that their piety would surely protect them against the Dutch bullets. But it did not. They died under the hail of Netherlands lead just as surely as would any godless infidel. And the Dutch military were quite evidently in the mood for killing that afternoon. When they opened fire with bullet after bullet, their intention did not include the taking of prisoners. 30 of the rebels were killed and 13 more were wounded, out of a total of perhaps a couple of hundred. When the identities of the casualties were checked days later, almost all of them were found to be Hajis, men who had waged war in the name of Allah the Merciful as the legacy of their long-absent spiritual leader, Haji Abdul Karim. Their 24 victims were either Dutch or else their Javan employees, Kafirs too in the eyes of the dagger-wielding fighters. There were civil servants, merchants, prison warders, wives, daughters. They were regarded by the Muslims as the initial victims of what would be an eventual Perang Sabil, a holy war in which all trace of infidel behaviour and attitude and people would be rubbed out. But of course, no such thing happened. The rebellion had been crushed. An inquiry was staged. The Dutch slowly instituted reforms. Taxation was eased. Strictures on travel were relaxed. A new mood of tolerance and ethical standards took root. In the kampongs, talk of the Mahdi's coming evaporated, as did the fanatical mood for war. An accommodation, uneasy at first but more comfortable as the years progressed, was eventually reached between the competing requirements of the Muslim and the Christian faiths. The peasants' revolt of Banten faded in popular memory. From today's perspective, the rebellion is regarded very much as a way station on the route to eventual Indonesian independence, the beginnings of the end for this alien peculiarity of Dutch rule so very far from home. The Islam that had driven the Bantanese to fight so brutally in 1888 became, in time, more of an organisational structure for the coming revolution, and less the banner under which the revolutionaries might fight. But the Indonesia that was born in 1949 was a Muslim state, and it remains one today, with Islam in Java and Sumatra today in a much more aggressive mood than for a long, long time. When those in the Islamic Church first turned aggressive, with the attacks on the soldiers in the late autumn of 1883, Krakatoa had just erupted, and the ruin and devastation that was its legacy made a wretched contribution to the miserable lives of millions of people around the Sunda Strait. Their misery was swiftly exploited, cynically, some might say, by the calculating leaders of the Islamic Church of the day. The melancholy condition of the Javanese and Sumatra peasantry was exploited by a corps of priests and scholars who had come back from their pilgrimages to Mecca and the Hadramaut, eager to recruit like-minded East Indians to help wage an essential first strike against the godless Western infidels and kafirs who were posing such a threat to the purity of Islam. To that degree, the eruption of Krakatoa did indeed helped ignite a political and religious movement that flared briefly and violently in Java, and which left an indelible mark on the polity of the East Indies. Had anyone been in prescient mood, the Banten Rebellion might also have struck a tocsin note, a warning of similar events that could well occur very, very many years later. And indeed, the bombings that took so many lives on the island of Bali in the autumn of 2002, for example, seem a haunting echo of these happenings in northwestern Java a century and a quarter before. Chapter 10. The Rising of the Sun. It would be a bold local fisherman indeed who, any time after the summer of 1883, would dare steer his craft between the cliffs and islets and shallows that form the outer shell of old Krakatoa and drop nets into the waters directly above where the volcano had once stood. The sea in these parts by now had a fearsome reputation. For a long while after the cataclysm, the Sunda Strait was a place that terrified mariners, and those who had to pass through it did it as quickly as they might. The idea of lingering to catch fish was quite out of the question. Merely to peer down into the sea and wonder what might be going on deep below would give most passers-by the shudders. The danger of a further catastrophe remained for a long while uppermost in the minds of everyone who had survived the first. For months, no one would venture near the charred ruins of the remaining islands. Only those who went out on the scientific expeditions dared, and they were reckoned foolhardy in the extreme. But economic necessity is a hard taskmaster, and by the time 6 months had passed, once the various Javanese gods had been placated with flowers and sweetmeats and offerings, and their anger assuaged, in part by the attacks on the Dutch soldiery, the fear and the apprehension dissipated, as it always does. Slowly, one by one at first, and later, in companionable little fleets, the prahus and the smacks were out bobbing among the Krakatoa reefs again, looking for fish. This time they may have been dodging the occasional clumps of pumice and stranding on the odd, unanticipated shoals, but their doughty and long-experienced captain soon took to behaving as though nothing much had ever really happened there. And such remained the case, the fishing ever improving, the waters placid and unremarkable and comfortingly deep, the volcanic dangers steadily receding in the public memory, until one day, after almost exactly 44 years, had passed. Then, on the evening of the 29th of June 1927, a group of fishermen who were hauling up their nets after a day spent innocently trawling for wrasse and sweetlips, and trolling by line for grouper and skipjack, witnessed something entirely unexpected and wholly extraordinary. With a great roiling and rumbling sound, a clump of enormous gas bubbles suddenly broke the surface of the sea. The bubbles seemed suddenly to be all around, to be rising in strange and random combinations, to port, to starboard, ahead, abaft. It was very confusing and very frightening. Exactly where under the sea these bubbles, which exploded in clouds of spray and ash and foul-smelling sulphurous gas, were coming from, and whether they were coming from one point or from many, was difficult to say. The panicky sailors, caught in the midst of them, seemed to think they were most concentrated at a point more or less above where Danan, the middle of the three former Krakatoa peaks, had once stood. As a sea mark, a point of reference, there had long been, near the centre of the caldera, a curious clump of needles of light-coloured rock that mariners, and the hastily printed new navigation charts, named Bootsman's Rots, or Bosun's Rock. These guano-stained pillars, nearly vertical sheets of andesite that are, with the peak of Rakata, the only real relics of the old Krakatoa, rise 15 feet out of the ocean, directly above the old central peak of Danan, like a gigantic club which Krakatoa lifts defiantly out of the sea, as one early visitor put it. Around the islets, the waters, alive with scores of sharks, are 600 feet deep at least. The pillars rise from some unfathomable depths, and most fishermen still regard them today as they did back in the 20s, as a warning to keep back, a reminder that the volcano, if not all fully there in person, was still there in spirit at the very least. And as if to underline the warning on this evening in June, the eruption of bubbles appeared to be coming almost directly from beneath the pillars, perhaps just a little to the northwest of them, and thus a little to the west of the old crater. Moving through the bubbles, the fishermen felt the water quickly grow warm, and there came a point where steam could be seen rising from where the bubbling had become most fierce. As the men paddled and sailed away as fast as they could, and as night began to fall, so they saw a diffuse red glow settle on the water, as if the bubbles were somehow mingled with fire. Dr. Verbeek, who had been the first to step onto the remains of the ruined mountain back in October 1883, and who had compiled his masterly study of the eruption 2 years later, would have known well what was happening. He had died in 1926, but in 1885 he had written, with astonishing prescience, "In any renewed activity of the volcano, it is to be expected that islands will arise in the middle of the sea basin that is surrounded by Rakata Peak, Sertung and Panjang, just as the Kaimeni arose in the Santorini group, and just as formerly the craters Danan and Purwatan themselves formed in the sea within the ancient crater walls." The bubbles were the first indication at the surface that a new volcano, lurking somewhere deep on the bed of this bathymetrically uncharted corner of the sea, was trying to build itself up. It came as something of a surprise, despite Verbeek's prognosis. When a survey was made in 1919, a shoe-shaped ridge was found to have developed to the northwest of Bosun's Rock, but there was no evidence that it was part of a developing volcano. Yet swiftly, in the aftermath of the random eruptions of bubbles and clouds of steam of June 1927, a distinct line of froth and bubbles and plumes started to develop in the water, such that by the end of the year, scientists were able to map a quarter-mile course through the water that appeared to mirror a rent in the seabed surface 1,000 feet below. The tenor of the activity then changed. The bubbles became more fierce. Large fountains began to play from the surface of the sea. Black froth, steam, spurts of ash and bombs of pumice began to surge from between the waves. Cones of water 60 feet high shot into the air with rays of black magmatic material like needles of jet rising 50 feet further above the water cones. As the eruptions became ever stronger, so domes of water, half a mile across, rose out of the sea, and the mixture of volcanic material within them gave a curious flecked appearance, with mottled layers of black and white and grey, so very different from the vivid blue seas all around. And then, most bizarre of all, flames started guttering on the surface of the water, and then shooting out in enormous yellow jets and sheets of fire. Observers had the impression that the water itself was now ablaze, or had been covered with flaming oil, as if the scene was the aftermath of some terrible maritime tragedy. Finally, on the 26th of January 1928, the volume of bubbles and flame became transmuted into ash and solid rock, and finally broke surface, and a thin curve of brand new land appeared for the first time above the sea. This new land grew black and sickle-like for several days, until it formed a humped and scimitar-shaped island, looking like a sand dune, 500 feet long and 10 feet high, with a concave steeper side on its southwestern edge, and a rage of smoke and explosions discharging from its base. A Russian geophysicist named W.A. Prechuchevsky was on hand to see the birth of this new piece of the world's real estate, and he gave it the name that its successor still has today, Anak Krakatoa, the son of Krakatoa. The mortality rate for new marine volcanoes is very high, and this one son did not survive for long. After a week, the relentless power of the surf and the tides wore it away, and all that was visible in mid-February was a patch of muddy-coloured water, occasionally pierced by a funnel cloud of smoke, steam, ash, and, every so often, small ragged pellets of hot and plastic lava. Then, some months later, a new island appeared once again. This time eruptions from two separate points created a pair of cones, which rose 700 feet above the sea and were joined to one another by a slender spit of land. But then the volcanic activity died away, the waves attacked and chewed away once again, and this new confection, after all too brief a life, slipped back beneath the surface once more. Corrosive encounters between this matched pair of seemingly equally relentless and powerful forces, the volcano and the ocean, went on for the better part of the next 3 years. On some occasions, the process of the volcanic creation won the day, and land was produced that survived for a while. Sometimes the equally awesome power of the rainy season, seas and tides and currents, made maritime mincemeat of it all, and reduced it to a pile of submarine grit. The number of explosions was prodigious. During the 24 hours from noon on the 3rd of February 1928, no fewer than 11,791 separate detonations were counted. On the 25th of June, an even more remarkable 14,269, 10 eruptions every minute of the day and night. The second of the islands stayed where it was for long enough for scientists who were in Batavia, attending the 4th Pacific Science Congress in May 1928, to arrange an excursion there and to do some real-time fieldwork. But they were vexed when the island slid back beneath the sea again, destroyed by the relentless power of the waves. Sometimes it wasn't just the waves that did the destroying. The newly appearing volcanoes occasionally self-destructed, blowing themselves to pieces, as happened with the third of the Anak Krakatoas in early August 1930. But gradually, and as a tacit reminder of the gigantic and unopposable forces of the subduction zone that was working away beneath it, the volcanic forces began to gain ground, and the island they were trying to create started to achieve a certain permanence. On the 11th of August 1930, the submarine vents made their fourth concerted attempt to sculpt a lasting memorial on the surface. They put up a ring-shaped island that had the appearance of a large black doughnut, and it stayed put for 2 days. On its second day of existence, a monumentally large phreatomagmatic eruption, the kind which results from the mixing of hot lava and hot gas with cold seawater, then tore upwards into the sky, reaching a height of almost a mile, and then dumping an enormous quantity of volcanic detritus back on top of the fragile wisps of island below. Those who witnessed the explosions noticed a feature that would soon be regarded as typical of this kind of eruption, the so-called cock's tail jets, in which upward jets of explosions are black with the material they carry, but with outer edges that are rich with condensing steam and so are starkly white, the whole phenomenon looking much like the tail of the more dramatic kind of male chicken. And the dumping of an enormous volume of new material all at once seems to have done the trick. It allowed the island a degree of permanence that enabled it to stabilise and consolidate itself. Ever since then, the rate at which fresh ash and rock has accumulated on the surface of the new island managed to exceed the degree to which the island's edges were eroded away by the ceaselessly ruinous action of the ocean. The moment that Krakatoa's son was fully born, it could be assured of the continued existence that it enjoys today. On the charts of the region, the hydrographers of the various navies, recognising the new status, steadily changed the colour of the island's outline from stippled blue, signifying new, temporary and uncertain, to the unbroken black that means established, permanent and fixed. It has been designated so ever since. Anak Krakatoa, or Anak Rakata, as the Royal Navy's latest chart of the region now calls it, has been, from August 1930 onwards, as permanent a feature of the East Indies as Java and Sumatra have long been, or, to be more realistic, has been as permanent as the islands of the Krakatoa complex that came before it. It has, however, been an extraordinarily active volcano, growing rapidly and unstoppably ever since its birth. The observatory set up on Panjang Island by Petrochevsky proved invaluable for the steady monitoring of its progress, as it grew from the 20-foot-high weakling, half a mile long, that started life in 1930, to the 500-foot-tall peak, a mile long and half a mile wide, that it had become in 1950, and to the 1,500-foot-like double-crated monster of an island that it is today. Its growth in size, from nothing, has been matched precisely by the growth, also from nothing, of its population of plants and animals. For when Anak Krakatoa rose from the sea, it was in all probability totally empty, devoid of life and, in essence, quite sterile. Both its surface and its interior were, it was thought, far too hot to permit the existence of almost any kind of living thing, and the island was far too new to have any history, to possess any former biology or botany that might have the potential to generate any kind of resurgence of life. The mountain was, to the fascination of biologists from around the world, a tabula rasa, ready to have the polychrome marvels of life painted upon it, layer upon layer, year upon year. It was a garden of Eden, yet a garden without plants, without animals, and without mankind, and with a whole world of scientists waiting to see what might grow there and what might not. But of course, what remained of old Krakatoa was a clean slate too, the island remnants most probably all burned and sterilised by the flames of 1883. These two locations, the ruined remnant of old Krakatoa and the newborn innocent of Anak Krakatoa, have thus become sites of enormous international interest, where answers are still being sought to two fascinating questions. On the ruins of old Krakatoa, how did and how does life recover? And on the Virgin Island that was later created in the midst of those same ruins, how did and how does life start? What were the differences, if any, between life returning and life beginning? Of course, these two questions could not at first be either asked or answered at the same time. Biologists had 44 years with only one site in front of them, which they were able to study. In those early days, there could thus be no kind of comparison. But ever since 1930, the three island remnants of Greater Krakatoa, if Verlaten and Lang Islands, or Sertung and Panjang respectively, are to be counted in ecological terms as relics of the old volcano, and the brand new single island of Anak Krakatoa have been standing there beside one another, inviting inspection and comparison. Biologists, from then onwards, have been able to examine each and try to work out if the mechanics of life recovering from ruin on the old islands and life starting from scratch on their new neighbour operated in the same way, in similar ways, or in very different ways. It's a study that continues today, more than a century after the creation in the Sunda Strait of what has turned out to be the extraordinarily useful biological laboratory of the new Krakatoa community. Not all the answers are in, by a long chalk. In considering the recovery of Krakatoa itself, and which was all that could initially be considered, 19th-century scientists had one significant problem. They couldn't be entirely certain what kinds of life had existed on the island before the eruption. And so they couldn't say in what direction the island was likely to attempt to recover, what state it might be under pressure, in other words, to return to. Clearly, it had once been richly endowed. John Weber's famous sketch, made when Captain Cook's expedition made its pause there in 1780, shows palms and ferns in glorious feral abundance. Present-day botanists have pored over the picture to try to ascertain the various species that Weber depicted. There's a type of grass which returned to the island in 1920, a palm tree called Licuala spinosa, which came back in 1982, and a fern which was first seen again in 1987. Following the sojourn of the Resolution, there had been some cultivation on the northern flank of the island, with a scattering of people living there, once even a small prison, and with goats, a vegetable garden, and trees grown for firewood. The very few scientists who had landed on Krakatoa during the 17th, 18th, and early part of the 19th centuries had collected specimens of grasses, pepper plants, orchids, and mahogany trees, as well as an unusual kind of parasitic mistletoe. One Dutch biologist went there looking for snails and found 5 different types, but no one had ever tried to produce a definitive, systematic list of the entire populations that existed before the eruption. All that could be said with certainty was that Krakatoa had been covered with a snail-rich, orchid-rich, pepper-infested and grass-floored tropical rainforest, more or less similar to that found in today's Sumatra. Despite this irksome lack of knowledge about what had gone before, the biologists from around the world who headed off in the direction of the Sunda Strait knew that what awaited them in the aftermath of the eruption could well be fascinating. It would, one of those heading to the island once wrote, be very interesting to follow step by step the progress of the development of new life on this land now dead, but which, in a few years, thanks to the intense heat of the sun and the abundance of equatorial rains, will surely have been recovered in its green mantle. The scientists found out with dispatch and with care. Just like investigators who take elaborate precautions not to contaminate the scene of a disaster or a crime, so most of the biologists who came to Krakatoa did their best not to sully with such usual contaminants as bacteria or seeds or rats or measles the rare post-eruptive purity of the islands. It was a purity which remained untouched for some considerable while. Rogier Verbeek was the first onto the island in October, a scant 6 weeks after the eruption, and he was too early when he first clambered onto the dusty shore, at a time when the island's floors were almost still too hot to touch, and mud flows were still pouring from the lava cliffs. He could see no living thing in sight, nor any evidence that anything alive might be lurking anywhere nearby. From a personal point of view, it was a shame. Given his heroic dedication to the story of the eruption, it might have seemed appropriate for him to be the first to find clear evidence of new life. In fact, it was a Belgian biologist named Edmond Cottot who spotted the first stirrings when he visited with a French government-sponsored expedition 6 months later in May 1884. The leader of the expedition had reported finding much the same lifeless devastation as seen by Verbeek. Of the magnificent vegetation which had been so often admired, there remains nothing but a chaos of enormous trunks, whitened and desiccated among the surrounding desolation, he wrote. It was dangerous, too. Rakata's main cliff was eroding fast, and rocks were rolling down its side in a ceaseless tumble, making an unending noise like the rattling of distant musketry. It took the men a frustratingly long time to find a sheltered beach out of range of the fusillades of bouncing boulders. But then Cottot, who had walked southward from the eventual first landing site on the northwest corner of Rakata, and who had managed to get all the way round the point to what is now called Handel's Bay, suddenly spotted something. It was nestled between 2 rocks on an otherwise arid and seemingly death-filled spit of grey and dusty land. This was the very first living thing that could with certainty be said to have appeared after the catastrophe. And it was, Cottot wrote with measured excitement, a microscopic spider. He looked hard for another, but could find only this single specimen. Yet significantly, and with a nice symbolism, this strange pioneer of the renovation was busy, he noted, spinning its web. The lonely little spider was hoping, in other words, that it would eventually be lucky enough to catch a fly. The arachnid's optimism was admirable, considering the trauma that must otherwise have unsettled him. Yet as it happened, though whether it happened for this one animal we cannot say, it was an optimism that was not at all misplaced, for within months an abundance of life, and that almost certainly included at least the modest sufficiency of flies required to satisfy a small army of spiders, began to return to the islands in earnest. This first spider's appearance on the island, and then the appearance of many of the life forms that subsequently resettled Rakata, in time triggered a question that has continued to vex and try the biological community for the many years since. Was there a chance that some of the animals and plants that first appeared did already in fact still exist on Krakatoa as survivors? Or had life on what remained of Krakatoa been utterly extirpated? Had it really been blasted and bombed and withered by the searing heat and then buried under 100 feet of ash? If this last was the more likely explanation, then all of the new life that went into the repopulating of the islands must have arrived on their shores and crags from across the intervening stretches of sea. And if this was the case, if all the newly established forms of life were newcomers, in other words, how exactly had they come? Had this one spider been lurking in a crevice, and though perhaps badly singed, had been sufficiently compass mentis to spin his web for Monsieur Cotto? Or had a passing seabird, the spider lodged in one of his claws, landed on the otherwise uninhabited island and left the spider behind when it flapped off into the air again? Had the spider floated in on a coconut husk, clinging grimly to the mesh of hairs until all the bobbing stopped? Or had it been borne in on the air, wafted on the breezes? Today it seems most likely that wafting was the means by which this one baby spider reached the seared shoreline of Rakata. It is well known now that some spiders and other wingless creatures have a propensity for ballooning, extending a thread of silk from their bodies and allowing the wind currents to catch it and bear it and each of the creatures off to an unknown destination. Ballooning spiders can travel effortlessly for scores of miles. The sea crossing to Rakata from either Java or Sumatra would take no more than a trivial few hours. And in drifting and wafting on the breezes, so this creature becomes a member of what has recently, and delightfully, been named the Aeolian plankton, wind-borne kin to the microscopic drifters of the sea. Once properly underway, the rush of life returning to the islands was impressive in both its speed and abundance. Crews of passing ships first thought they saw patches of green about a year after the eruption. In June 1886, an expedition spent 4 days on Rakata and found they were right. They counted no fewer than 15 flowering plants and shrubs, mostly beech plants, suggesting that these at least had arrived by sea, as well as 2 mosses and 11 ferns. The visitors also found a gelatinous layer of blue-green algae in a moist film on top of the volcanic ash. This layer, wherever it might have come from, probably helped spores to germinate, it was later thought, and provided some kind of support for their young and feeble rootlets. Clearly something had helped, because by the time a new set of visitors arrived the following year, there had been a positive orgy of rampant growth. There were now dense fields of grasses, so tall that a man could hide himself. The variety of grasses included Java's well-known alang-alang, which is always the first to grow, conveniently, after a forest fire, and rather less so after a farmer has cleared a field for planting. There were tufts of wild sugar cane poking out of the ash piles, many more ferns than the 11 that had been counted the previous year, scores of types of sand-binding creepers, hibiscus plants, self-fertilizing orchids, the red-leaved and very recognizable coastal tree known as the Indian almond tree, 3 varieties of fig trees, and a pine-like tree that the Australians named, for its resemblance to the lush plumage of their native cassowary bird, the casuarina. By 1906, the forests were thickening, the trees maturing, the climb to the 2,000-foot summit becoming ever more difficult as proper forests began to cloak the mountainside. parties of visitors now had to hack their way in, getting attacked en route by red and black ants and carpenter bees, being surrounded by swarms of colourful butterflies, slipping on large earthworms, taking pleasure in seeing kingfishers, nightjars, green pigeons, wood swallows, bulbuls and orioles. Some visitors had reported seeing a large monitor lizard and said that the coconut palms had returned and were lining Rakata's southern shore. Ever since then, the island has become entirely overgrown. Casuarina trees on the coast stand well over 100 feet tall. The mixed forests inland are alive with birds, among which are, prettily, the zebra dove, the pied imperial pigeon, the greater kukal, the white-bellied fish eagle, the Brahmani kite, the orange-bellied flower pecker, the pied triller, the mangrove whistler and the magpie robin. Together with beetles and centipedes, with geckos, dragonflies, grasshoppers and tree-dwelling snails, and, to the consternation of the descendants of Monsieur Cotto's first find, a pompilid wasp that is designed solely to hunt and kill spiders, and with a large snake that was initially identified as a boa constrictor, but which later turned out to be the species of the somewhat more congenial reticulated python. And civilian mankind's arrival, which was not always as carefully choreographed as the visits of those early biologists, resulted in the introduction of less comely animals. In 1917, a German named Johann Handel, to take one of the stranger examples, arrived on the southern end of Rakata with his family and servants and announced that he was settling on the old volcano as a pumice collector. He built himself a small house on Rakata during, and presumably to get away from, the Great War. He planted a garden and lived comfortably in this somewhat unusual hideaway for the following 4 years. But it turned out that he had, presumably inadvertently, brought along with him in his boat a breeding pair of the most unwelcome guests. A substantial population of Rattus rattus, the black rat, is now happily established on the island and makes mayhem among the nests of most of Rakata's coastal birds. And as the years wore on, so the numbers and types of plants and animals on the Krakatoan remnants waxed and waned, and in time created for themselves, by way of what outsiders call, of course, the law of the jungle, some kind of biological equilibrium, a state which is never perfectly reached, a kind of biological nirvana, endlessly sought in every kind of complex community, yet rarely entirely attained. Herr Handel's garden, once abandoned, filled quickly with 10 kinds of weed. In the early 1920s, a number of newly discovered large bees, velvet ants, fungus gnats and scoliad wasps, together with mosquitoes, crane flies, swallowtail butterflies, fruit bats and woodpeckers were found. In fact, when totted up, Rakata was shown, 40 years after the eruption, to be home to fully 621 species of animal, and by 1931 there were fully 100 species of spiders, according to a British spider expert called Mr. Bristow, the number and variety of everything swelling almost exponentially. Assuming for the moment that most of what exists today on the three islands of Rakata, Panjung and Sertung was brought in from across the sea and was not born out of hidden survivors of the island's original population, how did it all arrive? That first spider, as mentioned, very probably was of the ballooning variety. Other creatures and plants invaded by quite different means, all of them, when taken together, offering a powerful demonstration of the insistence of life to burst forth wherever it can, all showing the unquenchable nature of the fire in what the more romantic of today's biologists like to call the crucible of life. The first samples of colonizing greenery, for instance, the creeping beech plants and shrubs and the small coastal forests, came by sea, rafted across on driftwood and pumice and other debris, or hitchhiking in with birds that feed on fruit and then excrete their seeds. The pioneering plants found in the inland areas were almost certainly created from wind-borne or bird-borne spores or seeds, and they had to be tough enough to survive with very little water and in the full glare of the sun. Both they and their seaborne coastal cousins would have an additional advantage if they were hermaphroditic and could get along in an environment somewhat wanting for sexual partners. The presence of a thin veneer of blue-green algae helped too, and it may well have been the key to getting the inland plant populations properly underway. The figs especially were typical of what could be brought in by this method, their presence in abundance being evidence of the way that the fig tree, once settled, then manages to propagate itself. As the spread of those first plants increased, and as new ones were introduced and started to compete and then struggle for existence and room, as the botanical ecology of the island began to change, in other words, so the zoological ecology changed too. As the coastal grassland began to give way to casuarina forests, as the woods on the mountain's upper slopes began to get darker and wetter and danker, so the populations of animals altered. The butterflies and beetles and open country birds and reptiles that were the first to colonise the island, and which positively liked its dryness, started to be replaced by forest animals, geckos and skinks, by bats and by birds, the hobby, the barn owl and the hawk eagle, that favour shade and like to live in a warm world dripping with moisture. The overall result, a century and more after the eruption, is the existence today of a group of islands that have a markedly different biological and botanical makeup from the two great landmasses that lie 15 miles to the north, Sumatra, and to the east, Java. One example will suffice. On the Javanese and Sumatran mainland, there are 24 species of termite. 6 of these species live in hardwood trees, 7 live in the dead trunks of living trees, 6 in wet soft wood, and 5 make their nests in the soil. On Rakata Island, though, there are a total of only 8 types of termite. Not one of them lives in the soil. Only one likes to inhabit the dead parts of living trees. Just 2 like softwood, and by far the greatest number, 5 species, prefer to live out their days in hardwood trees alone. Just why this marked difference might be is still a topic for much reflection. Perhaps Rakata's soil is still too newly volcanic, or the dead wood is perhaps just not dead enough. Perhaps the environment is just fresher, more raw. There must be some good reason why termites do not much care for the island that once blew itself to pieces, and why they like the islands that have gone untouched for thousands of years. Because of unanswered questions just like this, Krakatoa has remained for many decades the focus of intense studies worldwide, a fascination for a score or more of the world's leading botanists, and the target of expeditions and field trips by the dozen. And yet, though the mechanics of the repopulation of the islands is now reasonably well established, the principal question that we set aside earlier remains sturdily only half answered. Was the first population entirely fresh and new? And did it arrive on the devastated islands by sea and by air, wholly coming from the volcanically wounded, but far from biologically sterile outside? Or was it not really new at all, but did it start off with seeds or with living animals that somehow managed to survive the original inferno? The controversy became so established a part of botanical lore that it long had a name, the Krakatoa problem. Its central question, survivors or outsiders, dogged entire generations of scientists and was the trigger over the years for some bitter, angry, recriminatory and downright insulting invective. Most of the ugly words swirled around the person of a forthright and feisty Dutchman named Cornelis Andries Bakker, who held the delightfully titled post of botanist with special responsibility for the flora of Java at the Buitenzorg Botanical Gardens, and who first visited the islands in 1906. Bakker looked sceptically at the notion, which was agreed by almost the entire botanical establishment of the day, that all Krakatoan life had been destroyed, and proclaimed it to be near total nonsense. He looked in particular, for example, at sweeping statements like that written by his superior, the Botanic Gardens director Melchior Troib, who had led the major post-eruption expeditions to Krakatoa, and had written, "At the time of the eruption, the trees felled or smashed by violent outbursts must have been half-carbonized, in view of the extremely high temperatures that certainly prevailed over the whole island. After that, Krakatoa had been covered from the summit right down to sea level, in a layer of burning ash and pumice. This layer had a thickness varying between 1 and 60 meters. In those conditions, it is clear that no vestige of the flora would have been able to exist after the cataclysm. The most persistent seed and the most protected rhizome must have perished." And Bakker weighed into these words with the kind of rhetoric hitherto unheard of in the genteel world of Edwardian botany. In 1929, he wrote and self-published a 300-page monograph in which he denounced the hasty and careless botanical work that had gone before, and which he insisted resulted in the lazy, easy conclusions that all Krakatoan life had been wiped out. He had a venomous disregard for those who had carried out the early studies. Troib, he declared as a prime example, was a man who was no florist and whose knowledge of tropical plants was very limited. Troib's expedition to Krakatoa had been much too short, the data acquired very incomplete, and his trip was so shoddy an exercise it's not worth calling it a scientific exploration at all, but rather a mere excursion of persons interested in the problem but not seriously devoted to trying to solve it. Other botanists who went later to catalogue the growth of new plants back are accused of misspending their money, acting under childish delusions, indulging in vague speculations, and making a series of expeditions that were a complete failure. The tone of his remarks set off a firestorm of criticism from scientists around the world, but the underlying points he made were all seen to be valid ones, the principal point being that no one, he said, had ever spent enough time or carried out a systematic enough survey to be totally sure that nothing had survived the original cataclysm. It was easy to take a look at the island and surmise that nothing could have lived through the fire, but it had since become well known that some kinds of seed not only survive fire, but actually need high temperatures of even this order of magnitude in order properly to germinate. Was it not in fact highly likely that such seeds had existed and survived on Krakatoa?